This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Welcome to episode number 195 of FilmWax Radio. I'm Adam Shartoff. I thank you for tuning in. And downloading my voice. This is actually a really good episode. It's two different segments. First is the CEO of Kino Lorber. They distribute so many great films. I mean, they are a machine on some level, but they have two facets to them. One is contemporary films, many art house films, and other types of indie films that stand out. And then the other segment are classics, going back to the silent era. They have an amazing catalog. And Lorber's been around. He is a fixture, and he's been around for many, many years. And but still, man, this guy is, you know, working in an industry which keeps him on his feet, and he's very much tuned into what is coming up in the future. He's very invested. He's as excited and enthusiastic as he's ever been, as far as I can tell. He spoke with a certain amount of excitement about what the future held for independent film, and so it was really great to get his perspective. And I don't think I've had many distributors on the show, so I'm really glad to bring Lorber on. He'll be my first guest. After that, I'm finally glad to bring Joshua Weinstein and Gene Tsien on to the show. They made a film called Drivers Wanted. It's going to have its premiere on America Reframed, which is on PBS's World Channel, beginning on February the 25th. That's coming up next Tuesday. It had a theatrical at the rerun, when there was a rerun, back in, the winter of last year. And I was there for one of the events, and man, was that a great event. They just packed the place. As we're going to describe in the episode, Drivers Wanted is really just essentially about the life of, and the people that work in this one garage in Long Island City. And Josh eventually wanted to do a DVD release event. And so what we ended up doing was we ended up having an outdoor screening towards the end of last summer in the parking lot behind this taxi garage. And Rooftop Films donated the screen, and I partnered up with Queens World Film Festival. You know, Don and Cato were there and helped, and so it was just this lovely event, and we got a great audience. I mean, first of all, everybody showed up. We had an enormous turnout for the fact that we were on the kind of a remote area of Long Island City, and yet we got a great crowd, and so it's a very fond memory. Speaking of great events, last night, I'm recording this on Wednesday, February 19th, and last night we had the screening of Cutie and the Boxer at the Brick House in Fort Greene. It was spectacular. This is the first real screening, at least of a real full feature film, that Brick has done since they moved into this new facility, and it was an amazing event. I mean, I guess I got to tell you, we had a line out the door. And it was, after I did the intro, I stood by the, you know, on the side to watch the screening for a few minutes. I've seen the film a few times. I wasn't planning on sitting through the entire film again, but I watched, and the audience was laughing from the moment go. It was so great. Afterwards, we had Zachary there, the filmmaker. We had Ushio and Noriko, who are, you know, the subjects of the film, and we did a Q&A with the audience, and it's all videotaped, at least the, you know, of course, the Q&A part anyway, and it'll be up on their Vimeo page, and maybe they'll be playing it on their new channel eventually. They're creating this high-definition channel that I'm going to be helping to curate, and very, very just honored to be brought into this organization. They're doing such amazing work there. So I thank the guys at Brick. I thank everybody who came out last night. We had a great conversation. And this is probably I'm going to guess, if not the last, you know, major public screening of this film before the Oscars. I'd be surprised, at least in New York anyway. And then I should pitch while I have your attention. Have you been to the Maisel Cinema up in Harlem? It's easy to get there. You take the 2 or 3 train up to 125th Street, and it's like a block and a half from there, north. So it's on Lenox Avenue between 126th and 127th Street, I'm pretty sure. 343 Lenox Avenue. Anyway, I am doing a screening up there as part of my Docularis film series, Docularis Funny Docs. The filmmakers Trish Dalton and Elizabeth Sperling, who have former guests on this podcast, will be there. We're going to show their film One Night Stand. It's a really funny and really engaging, entertaining documentary about, you know, the putting up of this three mini musicals overnight and performing them within 24 hours, performing them in front of a live audience. So it's a whole pressure cooker thing, and everybody is sleep deprived and trying to remember their parts. And it's so fun. So come up to the Maisel Cinema. There is a ticket price. You can go to the Maisel Cinema website. I'll put the link on the show notes, you can, you know, check it out. You should go up there and tap into your sense of adventure and come up to the Maisel Cinema on this Saturday, the 22nd. The screening takes place at 7:30. We'll have a Q&A. I think there's going to be somebody from the pretty sure one of the subjects of the film will be there. Have you met Al Maisels? Al Maisels will be there. I've been told that he will be delivered. Pinch me. It's very exciting to know that this guy, this legend, one of the pioneers of American documentary, of verite filmmaking, is going to be at a Filmwax event. So, but even aside from that, these events are great, and coming up to the Maisel Cinema is always a good time. So come up, let's talk, let's meet. It was great interacting with folks at the Brick event last night, and I'm looking forward to it again at the Maisels. Okay, so that's everything. I'm going to be back in between segments just to kind of, you know, introduce the second segment with Josh and Gene, but then come back after that. I'll wind things down with you and chat about life, you know. We'll wax about film. All right, so here's my conversation with a CEO of Kino Lorber, Richard Lorber. So, well, thank you, Richard Lorber, for coming on to the show here, the podcast.
Happy to be with you, Adam.
Have you done any podcasts or
here and there?
Oh yeah, okay.
Not recently, but I know what the word means.
Okay, so we're working into that advantage. Well, I'm looking in front of me at the big program from Sundance, the catalog. You're just back. Were you there for?
I was there for the duration, for about 7 days, and prior to that, I was at the Art House Convergence Conference, so been out of town for almost 2 weeks.
Oh, really? Where is this Art House Convergence, and what is that?
It's kind of started more or less as a sidebar to Sundance, but it has developed its own raison d'etre. It's a gathering of all the key art house cinemas in the U.S., independent art house cinemas, representation of some chains, all of which gather to talk about issues and problems and opportunities and challenges and the usual stuff that they're all facing, everything from the digital future to the complications of day-and-date VOD to the issues of, you know, very technical issues regarding, you know, the kinds of seats they should have and how much money they should be making from concessions. But over the past few years since I've been going, it's become also an opportunity to bring some distributors into the conversation to talk about upcoming projects and films and what's working and so on and so forth. Very useful. We see it's a small gathering, about 400 total attending, of which about 300 are representatives
exhibitors
from the exhibition community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you've been going for a shorter time, obviously, because, as you just said.
It started some time ago, but they've just opened it up to outsiders, meaning distributors, over the past few years. So I've been going for about 3 or 4 years.
What is the relationship like? I'm going off script already, but I'm fascinated because I do talk about these things, that little laundry list you just mentioned. It's something that I talk about with a lot of the filmmakers and other folks that come on this podcast, and it occupies a lot of my mind. And I'm wondering, what is that relationship like? And also, what was the big hot button?
Well, I think the past couple of years, the hot button has been the shift among these independent art house cinemas from 35 millimeter and video projection to digital and DCP. Even as recently as about a year ago, fewer than half had were DCP equipped, and now more than three quarters are.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So they were able to raise the money. They were able to figure out a way to fund it, and now that's not so much of an issue anymore. This year, what were some of the hot button issues? There wasn't any one issue that emerged as salient, but they're all sort of looking at their future and how they can survive and keep the, you know, the art house cinema business alive and well, or at least alive.
Of course.
It seems that many of the theaters are doing a little bit better than they had been doing, so there's been some stabilization. People do seem to be willing to go to see these kinds of movies, even if there was some deterioration of audiences for Hollywood cinema.
Yeah. I'm going to guess a film the size of somewhere between a computer chess to include at one of your titles to something like a Francis Ha.
Sure.
To those types of films, which seem to fill up a lot of the rooms at an IFC center or an Alamo Draft House, that kind of, right?
Correct. Many of these, about half of the venues that were polled or participating, are still one-screen venues. And if you're, you know, a one-screen theater in a small market, you know, you're likely going to try to reach for the major independent titles or the bigger boutique studios. The theaters of which the most profitable among the theaters are those that have three or more screens. And when they have three or four screens, they can afford to include a more diverse menu, which includes a lot of our films.
And speaking of menus, sometimes a sandwich and a beer.
Well, that's been another area of opportunity, is to be able to serve food and drink. And more the theaters are equipping to do that, subject to getting licenses and such. And
sure.
That's a growth area, too, particularly the drink part.
Yeah, the license for getting a cheeseburger might be a little easier. I don't know.
There are some arcane limitations on allowance of licenses. I'm also on the board of directors of Film Forum in New York. And, you know, it's something that has been looked at and addressed, and there's some bizarre restriction on it for Film Forum because of the height of the ceiling, which makes no sense to me.
But. Yeah. Well, as you said, these are grandfathered kind of rules that don't really apply to the... You know, they probably need to be looked at a regular basis, considering how fast the whole landscape is changing, right? Who would have thought 10 years ago that people would be talking about having a bar in a theater? And I mean, some people were sneaking in the beers, don't get me wrong. So, you know, I'm curious. We don't know each other very well at all. And so I'm kind of curious about, you know, your background and what that journey was that brought you to being the guy with the distribution company.
Well, it didn't start out that way. I really began my career as an academic. I was teaching art history, and I was writing art criticism. I was in a tenure-track position at NYU in graduate program in arts and art education. I had finished my doctorate at Columbia, and I was writing pretty extensively for Art Forum and for three or four other arts publications on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
I got to a point in my later 20s, 30-ish or so, that I just felt that the path I was on was not taking me any place particularly where I wanted to go, and I was very restless and looking to do more entrepreneurial things. I had also been doing a fair amount of independent lecturing and had some other schemes that I was pursuing. I was also involved in dance and editing a dance journal and such. So I left, and I, through some contacts, I found my way to a job in the up-and-coming world of home video in about 1979. I was marketing director of a company that was publishing directories of home video programming when the percentage of installed VCRs in American households was under 1%. Now it's probably 101%. But that gave me a snapshot view of this very exciting new industry that was being born, as was the cable industry at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, I started a company called Fox Lorber with a very good friend named David Fox. And we didn't really know what we were doing, but we figured we'd figure it out. And we got support from some pretty great people who were interested in our ideas. And we were consulting them. We were making deals for them, the likes of Lorne Michaels, for example. We were handling all of Lorne's specials for both television syndication, international sales, and setting up his first home video deals.
Yeah, whatever happened to that guy?
Someone said he'd have a future, but, you know, he certainly has had a past. Any case, one thing led to another, and we grew Fox Lorber over a decade into a pretty sizable company with some interesting turns in the road. And
roughly what years are we talking?
I started Fox Lorber in 81.
Okay, so I asked because back then,
yeah,
the video market was alternative distribution, or are you talking about stuff that was already theatrical and then went to distribution?
At that time, the video market was really nascent. There were a few independent companies, and there were the studios that were just getting started with VHS. Cable industry was growing, and HBO had just launched.
Well, they called a home box office then.
Yeah, home box office, right? We were not specifically focused on video, but it was one of the areas, and I had some expertise in that field. And we were also involved in television syndication and beginning to look into international sales. We were doing anything we could do, basically, to pay the rent, and went without even paying ourselves salaries for about 3 years. But, you know, in those days, you know, you could live on the fumes. In any case, after exploring some opportunities, the company matured a bit, and we added some staff, and I then started making deals. I sold and bought back and sold and bought back the company about five times before I sold it for keeps in the mid-90s. My friend, still friend, and then partner David Fox left the company around 1990 after I had merged with a Japanese company. And by 95, 96, I merged the company into a large telecom that had become a very substantial player in the telecom boom era and became head of the whole TV and video division, while Fox Lorber continued as a brand. This company called Winstar.
Oh, yeah.
And that went on for about, I remained employed with them until about 2001 when I left the company, and then the company, the parent company, the telecom, after raising $5 billion, you know, dissolved. I, at that point, fortunately, was in a, you know, kind of financially independent position and decided what I wanted to do. I spent some time thinking about things, and then I retired from retirement and put out a shingle again called Lorber Media and started anew, trying to figure out how I wanted to reengage the business. That, in turn, led to another company that I became involved with. I started a company called Koch Lorber Films, partnering with a company that's now called E1. To basically replicate the business model that we had at Fox Lorber, but with the direct releasing of videos and also setting up the beginning of the digital industry, doing some early digital deals. That continued for about 6 years, and then that morphed into when they were acquired by a Canadian conglomerate, our contract was up, and they decided that they wanted to move more into television, and I then took my marbles home and became Lorber Films, and that eventually became the platform for us to acquire Kino, which we did in with a partner and myself. We bought Kino in end of 2009 from my very dear friend Don Krim, who went to college with me and some 40 years earlier. We became friends at Columbia. And, you know, it was a potentially a very good partnership, and you know, I was, you know, the principal owner of the company and CEO, but, you know, we were operating as partners, and unfortunately he died 2 years later without my knowing, or he's knowing, that there was any illness on the horizon. Since 2009, Kino Lorber has become, you know, a more significant force in the distribution business, the art house boutique world of really bringing fine films to good screens. Our company's, you know, our staffing has doubled. We started with 14 in 2009, and we have about 26 people now, approximately doubled. We're releasing a very, you know, ambitious schedule of, we think, worthwhile films. And, you know, the company is doing nicely, I'm happy to report. It's never easy, but it's always interesting.
Well, thank you for the origin story. That's a lot of chapters.
I've left some out.
I bet.
And then the footnotes.
And a lot of good. We'll get to the war stories, and we'll have you back, and we'll crack open this bottle or something. So when you go to a Sundance, it's a marketplace, and you're going there ostensibly to buy up some films. What are you looking for?
Well, there are two parts to that question. It's what I'm looking for and what's looking for me. And, you know, I've been going to Sundance since the mid-'80s when it was the U.S. Film Festival in various incarnations of businesses that I've had. And I've been buying films there throughout that period. It's a kind of a baffling equation to try to navigate effectively. We don't have a large staff that goes. I go with one of my colleagues who's my head of theatrical distribution. We don't have, you know, interns doing analysis, and we don't have trackers, and we don't have, you know, lots of high-value market intelligence.
Yeah. It's not even a skeleton crew. It sounds like, you know, a few of the bones.
What we do have going for us is we have our reputation. We're known.
Right.
And we have relationships with a lot of the best of the sales agents and the representatives of the films there. So it's a triage process. You know, I look at I try to avoid even making myself distracted with the offerings of Sundance until I actually land in Park City, at which point I go into total immersion. And that immersion involves a triage process, as I was mentioning, where I try to kind of analyze, first of all, what titles can I forget about here? Because they're going to go to bigger companies if they're any good. And if they don't go to bigger companies because they're so bad, then I certainly don't even want to think about them at this point.
Yeah, right.
Then there are the titles that are possibly interesting, but there's no pressure to pursue them at Sundance. If I see them there, great. They almost certainly won't get sold at Sundance, and I'll be able to circle back to them at one of the other 15 or so festivals or markets I go to in the course of the year if they're still available. So that leaves a core of probably even less than a third, maybe 25 or 30% of the total titles that are Sundance. And among those, I can begin to make some, you know, reasonable prioritizations and evaluate, you know, what I think is worth seeing, and then see as many of them as I can. And this past Sundance, I didn't do the exact count yet, but my guess is that I saw between 24 and 27 films, or parts thereof, enough of the films to make a judgment about them.
Gotcha.
And we're probably, you know, we're actively pursuing about three.
Gotcha. So last year, if you can remember back that far, were there any that came from Sundance that you acquired?
The film that we really loved at Sundance, and I saw there first, was Computer Chess, which we acquired right after Sundance. We also, you know, have had good fortunes. In the previous year, we acquired Five Broken Cameras.
Yeah.
That was Oscar-nominated. And
that was at Sundance?
That was at Sundance. And then I'm trying to remember exactly what year. It was about the same time we also acquired the film that won the World Cinema Prize, Violetta Went to Heaven,
okay,
a Chilean film. And there have been many other films that we've acquired over the years, either at Sundance or films that premiered at Sundance, which we eventually bought subsequent to that in Berlin, as we did, in fact, Violetta Went to Heaven. We saw it at Sundance 2 years ago, but we didn't close the deal until sometime after Berlin.
Are you thinking at that point about, like, Computer Chess, for instance, and Andrew Pajalski was on this podcast right before it hit Film Forum. Now I understand exactly why, all the more why it screened there. But to be clear,
I don't have any thrall over
there. But it might have helped put it on their radar. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I wouldn't presume to think that you would push that. But
I could, but doesn't work that way.
Sure. And also, you know, were just putting, like, newly weeds. There were a number of atypical films that they've been playing with. Obviously, one of their programmers is trying to, obviously, insert influence there in terms of the kinds of films they're showing at Film Forum. The point being is, I'm wondering, you know, I would think that that's a hard film to market. It's like, it's not a comedy. It's not a horror film. It's not a documentary. What is Computer Chess, you know? And it makes sense at a place like True False, where nobody saw, you know, the very few people see it. But, you know, why choose that film?
Well, you know, we're trying to push the envelope, of course, and we are always looking for a good reason to give people an excuse to go to see a movie. It's a film that I thought was absolutely original and so quirkily, eccentrically special and different and funny and smart that it just felt right. The era that the film portrayed was very close to my own heart because I you know, was involved in my art world comings and goings than writing about video art and experimenting with handheld video equipment in the late 70s. So it's something that, that brought back an era that had personal resonances for me, even though most other people just look at it and scratch their head and don't know if it's if it's real or...
So there was this one had a nostalgic connection for you, obviously.
And it was just done in a very witty and, you know, in multi-layered way. And so it's something that worked. And the people who got it really got it.
Yeah.
You know, it very successfully compelled the interest of the people who, you know, were biggest appreciators of it. So.
Yeah, no, there's people that really, really love that film. And I think people that discover it. We'll continue to discover a film like that one, you know, and returning to it.
Yeah. The differentiator for our company from some great companies like Criterion and others is that, we release the classics, but the bigger challenge is to release the classics of tomorrow. And that's what Computer Chess is. We think it's a film that will live in the pantheon of classics of tomorrow.
So. Good way of putting it. Is that the conversation you have with Andrew Podolsky? What is that?
I mean, that's what informs my passion. You know, when I look at a film and I say this film really deserves to have a place in the future, and you know, it's not the, you know, just an evanescent experience. It will be written about. More people will become aware of it than ever see it, and maybe cumulatively over time, the people who actually see it will catch up with the people who have become aware of it.
Generally, that's how it happens.
Yeah, as opposed to a commercial film where more people see it than should be aware of it, and most of those people will forget it.
Yeah, right. It's almost as though you're talking about empty calorie kind of eating, as opposed to something that's more haute cuisine or something. It's a reasonable comparison, I suppose. So you mentioned before that sometimes the films are trying to find you when you go to a place like Sundance or maybe even day to day. And so I'm wondering, filmmakers, do they seek you out on a regular basis? I assume so.
Well, you know, filmmakers and or their representatives, meaning the sales agents, other distributors, they know what we do. They know, in many cases, what we pay or what we don't pay in terms of how high our financial commitments can be for certain films. But we've had a very successful relationship with many of the best of the business people in this independent film industry. Sometimes it is the filmmakers who know of us and revere our collection and just want to be, you know, sitting shoulder to shoulder in our catalog with, you know, with the likes of, you know, a Metropolis or a Computer Chess or whatever the, you know, the
classics of old and new, as you put it. Yeah. Cause I was wondering if a filmmaker doesn't have a distribution deal, if that's something that you're encouraging, I guess, can you handle that?
If a filmmaker doesn't have representation from a sales agent,
because
I'm the distributor.
Right. Because that's a big, I mean, there's no real place for non-distributed films to have a leg up. Wouldn't you say?
Maybe not. Things have changed. First, you know, to be really candid about it, and why not, we always do appreciate the level of filtering and curation that's done by a smart sales agent. It's the sales agent's job to reach into that slush pile or to go to the little obscure festivals and find that gem or to cultivate a relationship with a filmmaker that may just be coming to the foreground.
Sure.
We don't have the capability, the time, the resources to get to those stages in the capillaries of the blood system of of the film world, of the indie film world. So I am gratified when sales agents who we respect have already done their homework and they bring a title to my attention, and I'll pay attention to it because I trust their judgments in many cases.
Right.
And they're probably not in it just for the money either, really, because these are labors of love as much as opportunistic. Beyond that, there are films that come to us based on relationships, direct relationships we have with filmmakers from the 30-plus years that Kino and in my own life as Fox Lorber have been cultivating. So, and those, of course, are based on our own histories and such. But the sales agents play an important role for us in terms of filtering and, you know, identifying films. And the best of them are sensitive to what we do and who we are and how we can make the most. And it's not about an extra few thousand dollars here or there. It's about, you know, finding the right home for the film.
Right.
As far as films that don't have sales agents or distribution at all, this is the new era of DIY, of do-it-yourself.
Yeah.
And that's a fraught area of some treachery, I think, for filmmakers and for exhibitors. I think there are many films that would be better not being distributed, frankly, than to be forced into the marketplace on a do-it-yourself model, where a whole kind of pickup team of intermediaries is created to do the job of a distributor.
Yeah. Are you talking about like organizations that are, or individuals that are tastemakers and that kind of thing, or they become
advocates? I'm all in favor of do-it-yourself things,
sure,
generally, but there's been some polarization between the champions of the do-it-yourself ethos, you know, let's cut out the evil distributor, the money-grubbing company that's going to take all your rights and you'll never see another penny and you lose your independence and you never make as much as if you did it yourself. Now the tools exist to do it yourself. Why not do it yourself? Hmm. Well, after 5 years of experience with models of do-it-yourself distribution, I can give you very strong reasons why, without, you know, basically feathering my own nest here as a distributor, why there have been serious failures and shortcomings in the do-it-yourself path for many films. For a really terrific film, a very special film, it'll work on a do-it-yourself basis or with a good distributor. Mm-hmm. And the results probably won't be that much different. There are many, many subpar films that have gone the do-it-yourself route, and in some cases they've eked out some income and maybe more than they would have gotten from a distributor who shouldn't probably have taken that film on in the first place. But it's the polarization between the do-it-yourself model and the distributor intermediating model which has really become a serious fallacy in the market now, in that a do-it-yourself path is not do-it-yourself. It still involves legions of intermediaries, whether it's a booker and a publicist and an aggregator for cable and someone who will set up the video,
yes,
et cetera. It's right. Not really do-it-yourself. It's just basically being a general contractor with many, many other subcontractors handling the job that a distributor basically does in-house.
Well, there are cases, I guess, where somebody who's maybe established and has had many of their films distributed finally maybe has the, through whether it's a community they've built over years, they can sort of take more risks like that. I know that, for instance, Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady did that with Detropia last year.
Shane Carruth did it with Upstream Color.
Okay.
But the other issue here is that these filmmakers, and with Detropia, they also had the services of Michael Tuckman to do the booking, and they had other people to support the promotion and the marketing. So it's never
DIY-ish.
Yeah. The truth is that the filmmaker also has to put their filmmaking career on hold for pretty much a year or more. Mm-hmm.
Well,
process.
Yes. Right.
And
right.
That doesn't get calculated into the financial equation.
Right.
And often they wind up, whatever additional monies they make by doing themselves, when they calculate their own labor costs, they wind up making close to minimum wage.
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of them are doing it even when they have a distributor in order
We encourage that, and our sure. ethos is really do it together. And we love having a very motivated, collaborative filmmaker.
Well, who's a better ambassador, right? Who's a better advocate?
Great. They've been living with the project longer than we have, and we're doing. And almost every key film that we bring out now, particularly if it's a U.S.-based filmmaker, English language, if it's a film we're buying from an international sales agent where it's really a financial equation, we move on. But if we're really dealing very close to the filmmaking source, we may buy it through a sales agent, but the sales agent steps aside and they deliver the filmmaker to us. And the filmmaker could literally be living in this office with us. But beyond that, you know, we cultivate the social media outreach with them. We design the promotion and the marketing campaign with them.
Closely
we consult them in every possible way. And we hire at our own expense often the team that they want to have working on the film, whether it's a publicist or a marketing outreach coordinator or an art director or whatever, trailer cutter. All of these things are collaboratively decided.
Hired. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not a filmmaker. Well, then the last thing I'm kind of curious about is when there are cases you don't have your own internal digital, but you do obviously the DVD distribution is the a huge part of it of what you're doing. But as far as like the digital platforms,
we
work often with a third party a Fandor or a FilmBuff or correct.
Well, let me clarify that.
Thanks.
We are direct with every key digital platform in the sense we have a direct relationship and, in fact, an output deal with Netflix. We're direct with iTunes. We're direct with Amazon, with Hulu, Vudu, YouTube, Vimeo, et cetera. We are not direct by choice with the cable operator, so we would not do cable VOD on our own. And to the extent that we believe in cable VOD or think it's appropriate for a film, which is not that often because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what's valuable and what's working in cable VOD. In those few instances, we'll work with an aggregator like a FilmBuff or a Gravitas or a Warner Digital. But for the most part, to say that we're not direct digitally, we do have on one of our lines, we do have our own little site where we can make VOD available direct from our site. But for the most part, it hasn't been worthwhile. Our sites are not primarily consumer-facing. They're B2B. And unless we wanted to make a commitment to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to build a consumer-facing site, to really build an SVO, a subscription VOD model, it would be really foolish for us to make that investment now. It's better for
us when things are changing so
Yeah, better so for us
yeah,
to,
right.
to be the to retail it to companies like the Fandors and the Netflixes and
the Hulus infrastructure,
who are constantly pushing out consumer face. We're still a B2B company. Now, we do sell our own DVDs ourselves direct to customers, and we've been doing that in our catalogs and direct e-blasts for years, but that's a relatively small percentage of our total business, and we do that more to maintain relationships and customer loyalty.
I can get into the whole VOD cable conversation some other time, I suppose, Well, thank you. I just got something that keeps nagging at me that I was trying to remember to ask you about. But did I leave anything out from your perspective here?
Well, you know, I think what more can we say here? I mean, the business is changing. I can say that the takeaway is that in my 34 years of being in the business, since I really started in about 79, 35 years, up until about 5 or 8 years ago, there was some transformative change, some silver bullet that improved everybody's positions and wave that lifted all boats.
Uh-huh.
In the late 70s, the syndication television business was going down the toilet, and suddenly cable TV emerged, and it became a one-point buying option for someone who was selling programming. As the theater business was beginning to wither and there weren't enough screens and there was lack of interest in cinema, suddenly something called home video emerged and people could see cinema on their own TVs in the comfort of their home. When the VHS business was beginning to mature, suddenly there was a new technology called DVD, which made everyone go out and buy the same films that they already had rented or owned and replace their collections and introduce lots of new money into the industry. And that became the savior and the silver bullet that made us all, you know, momentarily somewhat feel like fat cats because, wow, this was a bonanza.
Yeah.
The pipeline filling phases. Today, there's nothing like that. There's no silver bullet that's transforming the fortunes of the independents, particularly. The digital business, you know, you've heard the cliche now, it's trading analog dollars for digital pennies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit better than that these days, but it's still not a thing like the feeding frenzy that we had in the early years of home video or even the transition from VHS to DVD or the move to cable.
Right.
And it's going to stay that way. So the reality is that there's nothing that's going to get us out of any kind of a financial jam. The business has never been tougher, but it's never been more interesting. it's been a totally fascinating ride to see this transformation into digital, to figure out the ways and means of making a new business as the traditional models are deteriorating. And I've never had a more, you know, enthusiastic feeling about being in the business and getting up and kind of wrangling with the challenges and the changes.
So we're not looking at any retirement scenario anytime soon, I hope. You know, wait it out.
Good to go. I'm in growth and learning mode here.
Oh, excellent. So. Good. Coming from an academic, that's good to know. Well, thanks a million for sitting down. And
Let's do round two sometime.
Oh, thank you. I was going to ask. I think he was a great guest. I really do want to have him back on, you know, at some point. When I was over there, they gave me all the swag. They gave me several, like, screeners. I saw a film called The Afternoon of a Fawn, which I think is still in theaters, possibly, up at Lincoln Center. Beautiful movie about one of Balanchine's, you know, prima donna ballerinas, and she ended up getting polio. Oh, it's a tragic story. But it's very good documentary. A lot of great archival footage, interviews with surviving folks from the dance community and who knew her. Great movie. What else? I saw a film called Who is Diane Kristal? That was at the New York Film Festival, I think, last year. But it's an amazing documentary. It's produced by Gael Garcia Bernal. And it's all about sort of unraveling the mystery of who this anonymous cadaver that was found in the Arizona desert. It was a Mexican who obviously had come into the States illegally and died trying to get through the desert. He represents just hundreds and hundreds of you know, poor, desperate human beings, and that are, in a sense, they're dehumanized through the whole process of illegal immigration and all this. And so it's a really powerful documentary, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. Those are just two examples of some films that are currently coming out of Kino Lorber. Next up here, my conversation with Josh and Gene. I kind of already described the show. I've been wanting Josh and Gene on for ages. We've worked together. We're finally now sitting down for a conversation for the Film Wax, the radio, and here we go, that segment right now.
I love the traffic. The worse the traffic gets, the better I like it. It keeps me alert.
In this business, to be a good cab driver, you got to look ahead and think ahead. You see a garbage truck in the street, you don't go into that street, it'll take you 20 minutes to get out of there, and time is money. Accidents. Have an accident? Don't panic. You never say, it's my fault, I killed all these people and find anything. The less you say, the better off you are. Okay? So if you have any problems, call us. It's not easy. It's a tough job, and it's very, very competitive. And you have to know how the city works. Every day is a different day.
Shoot, been driving the cab since 1945. My number is 16337.
We're sitting here with filmmakers Joshua Weinstein and Gene Chien, who collaborated on one of the more entertaining documentaries I've seen in a while, called Drivers Wanted. Correct me. You guys had a theatrical back in about a year ago. Had to be about a year ago.
It's 2014, so our theatrical was December 2012. Oh,
so it was about a year ago.
More than a year ago.
Yeah, and that was a rerun. I remember that. I was very impressed. It was how we met.
Oh, I loved the question. I loved the question you asked that night. Do you remember what you said that night?
Who's that pretty producer?
Oh.
Is she single? Not that one?
which producer?
No, Adam, you asked this very
what did I ask?
Philosophical question.
Oh, I did. That's true.
Flatter.
I did ask something obnoxious, right? It was the last question I might have ever asked in a Q&A now that I think about it.
It was like asking, you know, something about all of society is at the are the drivers the one really looking at us? You know, I know with the film we're looking at the drivers,
yes.
But is the film really about the drivers right. looking at us?
Yes.
But
yes.
You said it a lot better than that.
So I don't know exactly what I was thinking, but that sounds sort of like what it was might have in my head.
But you know, originally, Josh wasn't even sure that if he should be sitting the passenger seat shooting the drivers. There was one time we were talking about just doing the garage. And then once he get on the cab ride, it was like of no return.
Well, Josh, tell a little bit about the backstory, too.
They're full of life.
Eccentric.
There's a lot of individuals. There's a few eccentric people, but a lot of them are just so normal. I mean, they're just...
Yeah.
I mean, again, they're normal. I mean, I capture them at exceptional moments in their lives, but...
Okay, that's fair. But how do they cope with the stronger personalities if they themselves are just sort of normal? You know what I'm saying? Because what I witnessed at that Q&A that I was at was, you know, the big one. One of the big ones where you like had all the people from the TLC show up. Tell everybody a little bit about like also what the film's about too. But then and about that particular Q&A where I apparently put my foot in my esoteric mouth or whatever.
So, just to take a step back, and then we'll go into what the film is about. My mother was a cab driver. My grandfather was a cab driver. And Gene.
And my father was a restaurant worker, basically from dishwasher to a chef. So.
And he invented General Tso's chicken.
He was part of the General Tso chicken.
Collective?
He collected, yes.
There's a collective behind this?
There were three chefs, and then he was original. He knew the original recipe.
Oh, there was an original?
Yes.
That begs the question, was there a general so?
And, there probably was. I don't know. Was it a myth, or I don't really know.
Yeah, and how many Chinese food eaters has he killed over the years through frying this chicken? Okay, so but let's
back
go.
To the point was that
yeah, thank
we,
you, Josh.
We wanted to capture just the immigrant experience and the real middle class experience in New York City, and that was the goal with the film. So when Gene came up with the idea versus three different channels, Gene was offered to make this film about cab driving. We got involved, and it was more that I just loved to tap into the taxi garage just to see all these people, different people from all over the world. Have this experience together that's really like no other. I mean, it's more diverse than the United Nations, and the people are more honest than the United Nations, and just funny and real and beautiful. And now that we think about how cold it is outside, it's like driving a cab is one of the most difficult jobs there is. You have to spend about $150 a day that you do to rent your cab, pay for your gas and pay for your fees, and then you have to go out there and make the money back plus the money that you need to live your life. So
right, you're starting at a deficit.
You start at a deficit.
So
that, I mean, driving a cab is so difficult
yes.
that like besides just the financial difficulties and the traffic and if Obama's visiting, you know, and all of Lexington Avenue's closed and if the gas prices go off or if there's a gas shortage, like even the cold, like today, like some of my favorite moments in a film was just even the weather, the elements are against you, you know? And during a snowstorm, it's like, do you want to drive during a snowstorm? Because if you do, you could crash that car. And then the money you've already put down you have to fix the car, or you have to waste a half day while it gets fixed to go back out.
So is it worth even going out?
It's worth even going
out. The risks, yeah.
So anyway, it's more that I just – what's interesting about filming cab drivers was that every day there was real chance of something – some difficulty in their lives. And it's rare the other fields you have that difficulty that's going to occur every day.
Mm-hmm. Right. In such a just workaday context, because I mean it's basically just a workaday job like so many others, but most of those others, they're not taking those risks, and it's, so it's wondering why there isn't more of a steps in order to minimize some of those risks. It seems almost crazy considering, doesn't there?
I know. I mean, again, me and me and Gene are really interested in the people and in the physicality of the job and just the imagery. But, you know, the cab driving today is very different than it was when my grandfather, my mom drove. Back in the 70s, people just, if the boss had a good day, you had a good day. And if the boss had a bad day, you had a bad day. And you just split the money. And because literally, it was just a percentage system.
Okay.
You didn't pay money. You just split the money that you got in that day. And then also, there was even health insurance and other things happening back in the back. And then it all changed in the 80s. And I don't know all the politics or the reasons why. But
was it easier to own a car back then, too?
Oh, my God. A medallion, again, now I'm going to be ignorant about the price, but I think medallions, you have to buy two at a time now, and they go for over $1 million a pop.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, maybe it was like $15,000 per medallion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you invested in medallions, you'd be a very wealthy man.
So, Gene, it was your idea. You're the producer on Drivers. Let's say that. What?
A default producer. Actually, basically, this job came through me from someone else in London. So our friend, Lawrence Ellman, he wanted to make a film about the Kennedy Airport taxi holding area. Because he flies in from London a lot, and then he sees this area of about 300 taxi cabs at one time.
Yeah, sure.
They're the one who actually have to wait close to 3 hours to get one ride from the airport to go to the city if they're lucky. And the main idea for that was, you know, it was like a microcosm of United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see the Muslims in one corner do the prayers.
I see.
And then you have the different pockets of ethnic groups, you know, conjugate together. But then, so what happened was when we went to Kennedy Airport and then everything goes through Port Authority, in order to shoot either 5 minutes or 24 hours, it was close to $25,000 a day. You have to pay to Port Authority. So I told Lawrence, I don't think you have a film with documentary budget. So I said, why don't we go find a garage for you guys? And it's the same thing. It's, you know, it's where the taxi driver would be waiting. And it's so that's what we did. We start.
And you can, you know, in other words, follow them over the trajectory of a day whatever.
I mean, bottom line, what we most interesting is the human faces.
Of course.
So, you know, whether it's a taxi holding area in Kennedy Airport or a garage, it really is the same. It's the same job.
Yeah, of course.
And the best part was looking for this garage, where literally there's a list. You can find it online of every garage in New York City. And then me and Gene drove around for a few days where we would go from garage to garage to garage. And you'd walk in one place and somebody would be like, hey, Woodstock just showed up, referring to my big hair. They'd say. And another garage, we went inside to talk to the owner and we parked Gene's car. And there's like 10 guys outside smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. And when we come back out less than 10 minutes later, her bumper has been
dismantled.
It was
you mean the grill or the bumper?
The bumper.
Oh, really?
The back bumper was just gone. So
yeah, they needed.
So we asked around. Anybody saw what happened? No one. So then we felt that it was pretty dangerous job to get into a garage.
Well, it's more that some of these garage owners, who knows why they didn't want us at their garage, but they didn't want us there. I mean, there's a host of reasons why. I mean, I could speculate on them, but I don't know for sure, really. But anyway, people were turning us down left and right. When finally we showed up at a garage called 55 Stand on Vernon Boulevard in Long Island City, and I walk in the door, and here is this short, balding Jewish man named
Picture,
Stanley.
If you will, a cross between Mel Brooks and Danny DeVito. Yeah, that's a good guy. Yeah, diminutive kind of Jewish guy, yeah.
If from Brooklyn, named Stanley, and he walks, and we meet him right away, and he's like, it's your new home, do what you want here.
That's kind of verbatim how the conversation went?
Basically, he said, just come anytime.
Really?
Yes.
What?
He didn't know what he got himself into. Josh showed up for over a course of a year.
Did Stan show signs of wear at a certain point?
No, the truth is that it was mostly over a 3-month period, though. Like, during, like, the funny thing is, man, this film is so old to us.
Yeah,
I know. We shot it really
it
in December 2009, and we really finished most of the shooting in February 2010. Mm-hmm. Well, if you do the math, it's
4 years and
it's a 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we shot some more afterwards, but that was like I'd say a good 70-ish% of the film was shot in those 3-month period.
But you do know that, like, you know, and Gene can attest. Well, you've shot lots of documentaries, but I mean, they can take years. I mean, the shooting of it was relatively normal. It's just
this was beyond normal. It was the ratio was so low. We embarrassed to say it. It was pretty low.
What do you say?
Can I say?
You mean in terms of?
It's about 30-to-1 ratio, which is unheard of these days. 30 hours make it into 1-hour film.
Oh, okay.
And what I'm used to is average is about 200-300 hours to one. It's the average these days for an hour doc.
Yes.
Sometimes 1,300 hours. Mm-hmm. So this is really low.
Yeah.
But again, the whole point of the film was that I spent more time at the garage, you know, drinking coffee with people and talking about the Jets, because it was a great year for Sanchez that year.
Yes.
They made the playoffs. And, you know, just hanging out most time. And then just when something happened, then I turned the camera on. So it wasn't really a film where, you know,
you were
people
ready
are,
to go.
Yeah, about people are about to die at any second. You know, it's a film that
people
were playing chess most of the time.
And you are also capturing, to some degree, the workaday, the mundane. I don't want to say mundane in the sense that it's
right.
It's boring, but this is what you're trying to see is with the kind of the typical moments. So you don't need to like wait for somebody to grab somebody else's neck, you know, to have a kind of do your story.
100% right. Yeah, we just wanted to capture just what life was like. But again, like I just hung out a lot just to get that feeling, that emotion, just to get the familiarity with everyone because. Right. You know, as soon as you become just another guy there, you know, the less people are mugging for the camera. You know, I really don't like when people mug for the camera. It's so easy. You show up somewhere, there's always a guy who just goes, right, like, hey, look at me. I'm a big shot. Look at all my friends. Hey, cameraman. You know, and right. it's just a lot of hanging out got rid of a lot of just the mugging that usually happens, I think.
Yeah, right.
And it's just great for editors
mm-hmm.
to deal with 30 hours.
Oh,
and
God.
This is what I love about Josh's shooting.
You edited it, right?
We both edited
together. Okay.
But I think Josh did a lot of editing in camera. He knew exactly what he needed it.
Well, yeah. Does that come from doing a lot of editing? As an editor, from perspective, do you come to a movie like Drivers Wanted with already that in mind? Like, I'm going to be economical here. I know I can shoot in a very economical way, blah, blah, blah. Like,
well, it's really that if you're the director and you're the cinematographer, you can make mistakes. You know, if I make a mistake, I'm okay because I know how to solve the problems. It's more that I don't have to – when I'm working for another director, I have to shoot more because I'm not in their head. I don't know exactly what they want. I know exactly what I want.
Yeah.
So it's just more that because I'm the director, it just allows me not to turn that camera on if I don't want to turn it on.
Right.
And that's all. Yeah, again, and I know what I want.
Actually, that's really difficult to do, to know when to just turn the camera on. It's like editing. I heard from a great editor, Nancy Baker, once she said, you know, the best editing is when not to make a cut.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very similar.
When did you guys meet? What were the circumstances?
Gene, you tell this story.
Two of them are like finishing each other's.
I'll start the story and you finish the story.
Just to prove that they finish each other's sentences.
I just want to say that making this film was like making a film with your aunt, you know? It was really like Auntie Jean. No, just a really fun, big family of affair doing this event. But basically, in summer of 2007, I was making my first film and I had the audacity to call like the best editors in New York City. You know, editors that are making $1,000 a day. Wait, you're making that?
Who's somebody you talked to?
Fine, but thousands of dollars, whatever.
Who did you talk to?
Compared to me that time, who did I call? I called Richard Hankin on the phone. I spoke to Nancy Baker. All the big shots I called up.
Mm-hmm.
But only one person got back to me.
Really?
No. And it was Gene. Gene, that's how the softy Gene is. But everyone else turned me down. Gene's like, okay, I'll take a look at your film.
Mm-hmm.
And I rode up. I biked, you know, August in New York City is humid affair. And here I am on my bicycle. Mm-hmm. I bike up to Midtown with my DVD screener of my first
film,
Flying on One Engine. And I drop it off with Gene, and I'm just like a sweaty mess, okay?
So I saw this kid showed up, sweaty.
And I'm 23 years old, okay?
And so the first thing I saw Josh, I say, would you like a bottle of very cold beer, and he accepted. And I just took the DVD, and I sent him off. And then I watched the film.
Not expecting much.
And I just say, this guy, I mean, I called him a kid back then. He just graduated from BU. Mm-hmm. And I say, this kid can shoot. He's got a lot of heart. It's a film about this Indian doctor
Do you want to hear about
that? Yeah, I do. Okay. More importantly, I'd like to see it.
Yeah, I'll give you some DVDs. It's about this doctor. His name is Sharad Kumar Dixit, and he's a plastic surgeon. He lives down in Kensington, and he's performed almost 200,000 free cleft lip operations and other sorts of cosmetic surgeries. But which is amazing, his work, and supposedly he's a 7-time Nobel Prize nominee, but he's also this... He's in a wheelchair. His heart only works 18%. He doesn't have a larynx, so he talks kind of like Yoda meets Darth Vader. And he's hysterical, and he drinks a little bit, and he thinks women are hitting on him. I mean, he's just an amazing... But, you know, again, it wouldn't matter his personality. It's all that matters is he does fantastic work, but he's a human at the end of the day. And it's more than interesting because we always take these people... who are Mother Teresa's, whoever, we put them on a pedestal, you can never be such a person. But what interested me about Dr. Dixit was that he was a regular person. And again, just a family connection was he was my father's teacher, and my father also volunteers in India and does these free cleft lip operations. And
your dad's a surgeon.
Yeah, and Dr. Dixit passed away a few years ago. I know, I mean, he lived a long and incredible,
especially
amazing
considering
life.
The condition that his condition was in.
Yeah.
How old was he when he passed away? Do you know? Roughly. Would you say 70, 80?
No. I would say late 70s.
Okay.
Late
70s. So, yeah.
But now my dad and an Indian doctor now run his charity. But again, it's really just like, it's a charity by the shoestrings. Like, it's just literally like, they say, you know, Project Smile and all these other things, they spend thousands of dollars per operation. They really do the operations for just the price of whatever medicine's used for the operations. Like, the doctors don't take any money. No one's getting paid. They pay for their own plane tickets to go over there. I mean, the whole point is, like, here's, like, just giving back in the truest sense possible.
Is the percentage of cleft lips much higher in India?
So it's marginally higher, but the causes of cleft lips are multiple. Cleft palates are multiple reasons. One is that if close relatives, like first cousins, get married, that also, I mean, it's a recessive gene. Also, alcoholism and smoking cigarettes can also cause this. So
it can.
I mean, if the mother is smoking or drinking
during pregnancy. Yeah.
But besides that, it's even with those two features that people don't know that much about in India, it's still not that much higher percentage wise. It's just that the health system is a lot poorer there. So in America, if this happens, they get it done within the first few weeks, the few months of their lives. While in India, they just don't have the opportunity to do it.
Right.
So that's really the higher cause that we see in Southeast Asia and Africa and other more developing countries. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so you met over the course of Gene. You saw this film.
So you have to see.
Was this
film.
A short or was this a feature?
It was a 52 minutes.
So right in the middle.
Yeah.
Awesome. Driver's Wand is not much longer. Yeah.
We like mid-length.
Me too. And you know, Josh, in that with you guys in that way is our pioneers, because I think don't look at me like that. She's like, oh, how is he going to explain this one? Because now the way that distribution is evolving, you can make different length films. We're not tied into what is called the festival length or the TV length or whatever. I mean, you can of course edit for all the above, and you know. There's a POV TV length, running time, whatever you want to call it, and feature running time and all that. But the point is you could do it. You can also have a film can have a life at whatever its organic length is, because of places like Fandor and other sites now, and the way people are viewing is changing. And, you know, you don't have to fit in some other model,
But the good Lord did shine upon us, and with the length we have, PBS's World Channel, America Reframed, is broadcasting the exact length.
Come on.
I'm
not
serious.
Possible.
The exact length. Not an edit was added.
Driver's Wand, it's going to be on TV.
Not an edit subtracted. The exact length we did, they're allowing it on.
Wow. It just happens to work like in an hour or so, right? Yeah. Doesn't it? Driver's Wand, directed by Joshua Weinstein and edited. Co-edited and produced by Gene Chen. It's a highly entertaining work. We did a screening together
Fantastic.
It was. It was one
Adam
of my favorite.
Brought the show.
Well, I think everybody did, including the Queen's World folks, Queen's World Film Festival folks, remember? That was a good idea to bring them on because we did it at the in Long Island City at the garage. We even to the last kind of minute, we weren't sure what was going to happen that night, but it could have gotten better. Rooftop Films were helped out. They contributed the infrastructure and
And just to see cab drivers like sitting on taxi cabs watching the film, it really felt like watching the film in the space, seeing the taxi cabs. It felt like a whole movie, but real. Like somehow it just seemed like people have seen 3D films. This was like a 12D film, you know, just the sensory, the smells, the local sounds of the hydraulics
like
happening.
Marty DeBurgi from Spinal Tap. The sights, the what did he say? The sounds, the smells of the like life on the road with Spinal Tap. But you're right. It was one of those things where we didn't know, but everything kind of just worked out beautifully. I think there was this like literally we got down to the last chair. And like we just kept bringing out more chairs and adding more rows because we just said, oh, we need 30, 40, but bring 75 chairs just to be safe. And meanwhile, then I called them back later, remember, bring 100 chairs. We're getting nervous. And then like they all got filled.
Josh and I actually was making bets
you
before
did.
The
That's
screening.
Right. I was in it. You won.
I say 50 and Josh say 100.
I know. I think I split the difference. And I think I said 75, which is typical of a Libra. Go ahead.
The best part about this film is that our sound mixers, John Bosch and Jorge Belon, they mixed it all the way to 11. They didn't do just the 10. Most sound mixes only go to 10. Our sound mix went to 11.
Mm-hmm.
A Spinal Tap reference.
Oh,
there, right?
Yeah, there's another one. I thought that you... I knew that, but I thought you were now actually trying to... Never mind.
They don't bring up Stonehenge.
Exactly. But what also was interesting about that, memorable, I should say, more than interesting, was that your venerable driver, Spider,
Johnny Spider Footman.
Johnny Footman, also a.k.a. Spider, right? He is he was the oldest working cab driver in New York, maybe even anywhere, I don't know. But point being, he was supposed to come. The word was he was going to make it. They couldn't. And then I think he died within days of that screening, didn't he? A week or two.
Yeah, I spoke to him the week before. And honestly, he was incredibly excited. He came to one screening at Rerun in Dumbo.
Yeah.
And first of all, he left in the middle to use the bathroom. I spoke to him outside. And he's like, this is a movie. He's just like, he couldn't believe that he was in a real movie. He was on the floor that he was in a real movie. And then the women. Oh, my God. He was hitting on every single woman there. He was having a ball. He had a half a glass of wine. He was spinning. He was having a blast. And he couldn't wait to do it again, actually. And we talked on the phone, and he was so excited to come. And then, yeah, a few days later, he passed away. And
yeah. How old was he?
94. But 94. And I'm really proud to actually was able to pay tribute to someone like Spider. And that was exactly the reason why I wanted to work on this film. It's really gave a voice to those hardworking New Yorkers.
Right.
Like my father was, a Chinese restaurant worker.
Well, yeah. Right. I think all of our parents or grandparents come from that that generation because they're all immigrants. So it's going to be on American Reframe. Do we have the specific date?
We know it's going to be on Tuesday, February 25th.
Okay. Check your listings. The World Channel.
The World Channel, but it's different timing in every city. So it's, got to check the website.
Okay. Yeah. We'll put that up on the show notes.
But besides that, the garage is still ticking away.
Stan's getting up there.
Stan is getting up
any
there.
Any words about retiring or anything?
He's not. No way. He's like, I'm going to play golf. He doesn't want to play golf.
No, he's not a Florida golf guy. But his son is there, and at least one of his sons. I don't know is the story, but I met one of the sons.
Yes. Yeah, so how great was that? That his grandchildren brought popcorn to the screening. You remember that?
Oh yes, they were selling it at a.
Oh, yeah. And then they gave it away. Also, remember we had taxi yoga that. We had the yoga guy, remember? This was like, honestly, one of the best events.
The guy who did the taxi yoga at our screening, he actually runs the taxi school in Queensboro Community College, LaGuardia. And Josh and I, we talked about once to get our license, take the class, pay the $500, get a taxi hack license. We never did.
Oh. It's so just updates, though. So Stan still work plugging away. Spider, you know, sadly passed away in September. And Eric, the other main driver.
Yes. Is that the
That's a Chinese
Korean?
Driver.
Oh,
yeah.
Chinese.
Yes, Chinese. And he is doing fantastic. He works full-time for as a private driver for a businessman. So he's a limo driver. You know, it's great. Loves the work. And then he still drives, though, taxi one or 2 days a week on the weekends.
Okay.
So he's working 7 days a week. And but he loves it. And again, Eric, the one that I love the most, I mean, just some of the things that he told us, like, I love the smell of gasoline. It's so refreshing. And here's a person who grew up under communist China, never had the ability to drive, always dreamed of driving a car, and here he is. He's in the greatest.
Do you think he means by association, or do you literally think he, or do you think he literally means he likes the smell? Yeah, because that's an odd thing to like the smell of. But I guess.
Well, if you never smelled it in China.
Oh, I see.
Back then, when he was a child.
Yeah.
You know, it's like luster to smell that.
It's,
yeah.
Well, that's kind of what I meant by association. You know.
Eric's just the whole story about coming here and always dreaming of driving. You know, a car for him growing up was like living in a mansion to someone, you know, who grew up in a small apartment in New York City, you know. And here he is. He gets to drive one every day. And you think that it would fade and that – and I'm sure it has faded a little bit. But for the first year, it was – I mean, he talks about driving over the Queensboro Bridge, at 4 a.m. in the morning and just seeing the city.
Oh, yeah.
And just thinking like
– I had that. And I'm, you know, 50-year-old schnook. But when I drive – in the morning, when you go over sometimes and you have the – it's quiet and you're going in there and it hits you. It's like, this is incredible. I live in the best place in the world. How the fuck do I get out of it, though? I'm moving to Florida and playing golf. Go ahead.
Oh,
Century
man.
Village, here I come.
Yeah, the Century. Oh, no, if I would ever play golf.
That would be funny. Like, get you and me, there's a documentary. Get Josh and me on the golf course. We'd probably kill each other within.
Do you play?
Me either. One or two holes were. Our handicap is just breathing. You know. All right, guys, we can wind down. Check your local listings. It's America Reframed. It's a terrific series. POV, it's on the World Channel, but it's basically POV on steroids. I don't know. I made that up. I just made that up.
They're in the POV office. I know people from POV work on the show, but it's a separate show.
It's overseen by the people that it's part of the POV machine, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been Carmen and Simon,
Kilmery and Cynthia
and
Lopez
and everyone has been so supportive, and we're really excited to put it out there.
Well, hopefully they'll help put this episode out there of this Filmwax Radio too.
No, they already told. They already. It's part of the contract.
Well, I'm so glad because we sat down because oddly enough, I think you're the first time you and I met. You kind of pitched the idea of doing that, and I'm like, who? I don't even know who this guy is. Like, I hadn't seen Drivers Wanted, and it was a rerun. I remember it because you don't forget meeting Josh.
Yeah.
No, you don't forget meeting Josh because you know he makes a strong impression, and so. Oh, well, only the best way possible. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's why a year later we're sitting here. A year and 2-3 months. Because you were about to have – you had your postcards or something. And I was involved in some other screening or just hanging out at the rerun bar. Do you remember this? And you came over to me.
Yeah, I went to
and
see Gaby.
Yeah. Oh,
I love Gaby. Oh, yeah. It was fantastic.
Yeah, of course.
Posters. This is just hysterical. This just shows you the good Lord shining back down is that – the city of New York for iTunes release. So again, that's why things keep on happening. So we had a theatrical year 2 months ago, and then in September was the digital release. And I couldn't believe this, but the city of New York gave us over 300 billboards on the subways, on bus terminals to promote the iTunes release. Plus, they showed us on Taxi TV for 2 weeks.
Okay, so Josh, Gene... when I say I'm so happy you guys this worked out and that you guys were on, I mean I couldn't be more.
This is really fun. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks, and thanks for making getting Gene to come out too.
Shishi.
Yeah,
Shishi.
Happy New Year. Yeah.
Actually, we're really happy to be broadcasting February 25th. Mm-hmm. It's the Black History Month in honor of Spider, mm-hmm. and it's the Chinese New Year.
That's right,
in
the honor Lunar
of,
New Year.
Of Chinese yeah. driver.
Very much so.
And what Jewish holiday?
And it's the year of the spider, if I'm, unless I'm incorrect. I probably am. What was it? It was the year of the what was it?
Horse.
That's right. Who could forget? Who could forget that? Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
That was the show. Next week, I'm bringing on this really interesting filmmaker. He's got a bunch of short films on Fandor's website. It's going to be my monthly Fandor episode, actually. His name is Jay Rosenblatt. He's been making these great found footage documentaries for quite a while. And they are powerful. They're very moving, very emotional, very personal stories, yet told through using and manipulating found footage stuff from old movies, old industrial films, and whatnot. I'm just probably not describing it that great, but when you see an example of it, you'll really dig it. I guess you can call him an experimental filmmaker. We have a really great interview that's coming up next week, as well as a conversation I have with a couple of folks from IFP, the Independent Filmmaker Project. I haven't had anybody on since one of my first episodes where I had somebody from the IFP on, so it's been a couple of years since I've talked to anybody there, but they do so much tremendous work. It's incredible, and I really need to make this a regular thing. Also, if you're listening to this tonight, Wednesday night, the 19th, I forgot to mention, if you're an IFP member or a Spirit Award voter, a Film Independent member, and you're listening to this, and if you're planning on coming to the Made in New York Media Center tonight in Dumbo, I will be there at the screening of Blue Caprice, Alexander Moore's film. They're going to be showing that for your consideration, and then I will be having a conversation with Alexander. Yeah. I'm very excited about that. I haven't met this gentleman, and yet I really, really love this film. It's very dark, but terrific film. And then I should have mentioned that before, but I forgot. So there it is now. Anyway, that's what's coming up next week. That also, I'm going to probably throw up an episode, which is like, I actually, over the last year, have talked to all five of the documentary Oscar nominees. I will have a show up with clips from those episodes. As the Oscars are coming up Sunday, March 2nd. So it's my Oscar show, if you will. It's my version of an Oscar show, anyway. All right, well, folks, I say this every week because I desperately need your subscribership. So if you would, take a moment and go to iTunes and just subscribe to the podcast so it comes to you and you listen to it regularly as possible. I would appreciate that. Also, leaving a star rating seems to be quite essential. Because as the more people that leave star ratings, hopefully multiple stars, my little podcast here will move up in the ranks and be seen by more people. And it's a great gift you would give to me by doing that. And if you can go to facebook.com/filmwaxradio and like the page and get on the Twitter feed at filmwaxradio, all these things are tremendously helpful to help continue to bring me resources in the end, like great guests, but also maybe sponsors and other relationships that will benefit me and hopefully benefit you as a listener. And you can reach me at adam@filmwax.com, by the way, if you have any suggestions, thoughts, feelings, comments, and otherwise. I'd appreciate that. Okay, guys, episode 195 shutting down here. You've been listening to Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. I'm your host, Adam Shartoff. Until next time, thank you.
The difference from the Saturday night where the lights spread dark around the drunkards in the headless hallways where bodies are put on the marketplace to happiness endlessly taking pills with the young going down. I see nothing.